Distinguished colleagues, it's a great honor to have the opportunity to talk to you about international scientific collaboration. Much of what I say is going to be taken from a report published earlier this year by the Royal Society, which you can find on the Royal Society website. We are behind time, and when I arrived in Budapest and read the program, I found I had less time than I had thought when I prepared this talk, so I'm going to skip some slides, and I'll go quite fast because Gretchen said some things that I'm going to say, and she said that I could have the 3 minutes that she saved. So the talk will be in two parts. I want to give you some figures on the changing scientific landscape in the first part, and in the second, discuss the challenge of harnessing science to address global problems. Let me begin with some headlines. Science funding has been going up a little bit less now with the recession, more or less in line with GDP, but in the developing world, it's been going up much faster in some countries. We're aware of the rise of new powers, all of us, China, Brazil, India, Korea, but as I'll show you, science is taking off in many, many other countries. The World Wide Web and technologies such as Skype and reduced travel costs have enabled an enormous increase in scientific collaboration, and I'll discuss that more. There has been a blurring between universities and industry. Universities are getting involved worldwide in spinning out companies. And on the other hand, industry, which needs an increasingly broad range of skills, is outsourcing much of its research to universities. And they don't care where those universities are. They go where the best science is. And in parallel with the closure of some of the old big central labs, some of the companies like Microsoft are setting up many labs around the world to be close to markets. I want to discuss publication trends. These are from Elsevier data for peer-reviewed publications with the abstract in English. 80% of the papers, the rest of the papers in another language. This is social sciences as well as natural, but only about 9% social sciences. This is, of course, relatively academic science and doesn't capture technical reports and material of purely local interest published in a local language. I want to make 3 points about this slide. First, the area shows that is proportional to the total number of publications. Look at the enormous growth between those two periods. Second, look at the very rapid rise of China. And I'll come back in a minute to what may happen in the future. China's now number two and set soon to be number one in the world in terms of publications. Next, the third point is the rise of other in that graph, from 30% to 34% of a much bigger total. Science is growing all over the place, and I've given some examples here. There are still some white areas on the map in the least developed countries, in Africa and so on, but at least there I find that the leaders are speaking the speak and saying the right things, so we hope to see a growth of science there also. What will happen to publications? If you make a naive extrapolation of the last two data points which we had, you will see that China will become the number one publisher in 2013. In fact, when you look a bit more seriously at other indicators, probably 2015, but certainly in this decade, China is likely to become the biggest public producer of scientific literature, of peer-reviewed scientific literature in the world. Of course, it's not just quantity that matters, it's quality, or rather, quality-weighted quantity. So let's look at the citations. There, the traditional order still holds. And personally, I'm pleased to see that the UK is still number two. But that's not going to last very long. China is moving up. Obviously, there's a lag. You can't quote papers till they've been published and you go on quoting them. Secondly, when there's a big rise of the scientific community, young people, it takes time between people and the rest of the world say, this is somebody whose paper I must read. So I think we can expect to see China rising up very rapidly. Whether it will ever reach the level of the US, I don't know, but I certainly expect it to become number two, if not number one, in the not too distant future. Another measure of a different sort of quality is patents registered in the USA. Look at the bottom line here. It shows the total number of patents, and between 1989 and 2009, you see they've gone up about 70%. And the USA, naturally, takes the lion's share and has remained at around 50%. At the top of the league table, Japan and Germany have stayed number one and number two from outside the US. But below that, there are dramatic changes. Here, I'm sorry to say, the UK has plummeted, not quite as fast as France, which makes the Brits happy. But we see the rise of South Korea, from nowhere in the first date to the middle, now number three. And for the first time in 2009, we see China showing up here. So there are big changes going on. What about collaboration? This map, the lines are proportional to the number of jointly published papers. I will unpick some of the headlines from this in a minute. 15 years ago, 25% of papers had international collaborators. Today, we're up to 35% of a much, much bigger total. It's much easier to collaborate. And the collaboration is driven by three things. Bottom up, the scientists seek out the best collaborators they can persuade to work with them, wherever they are. They don't care where they are. And the best facilities which will grant them access. Efficiency, things like the LHC, the Human Genome Project, need a lot of people. And finally, necessity. If you're studying the changes in biodiversity or the effects of climate change or the spread of disease, you need data from around the world, so you need collaborators from around the world. This graph shows the importance of collaborations for different countries. Let's look first at the USA. So the point down on the left is 1996, and up on the right, 2007, and I've joined up the dots to make it easy to follow. On the vertical axis is the number of papers produced in the United States in international collaboration. So the United States is the most important collaborator for the rest of us. It's the major hub, followed by the UK, Germany, and France. On the horizontal axis is the proportion of papers produced in international collaboration. And you see that in the USA, it's 30% below the world average. For obvious reasons, there's a big domestic pool of potential collaborators, but for the rest of us, collaboration is much more important. And for smaller countries, not shown here, like the Netherlands and Denmark, it will be off scale on this graph. I'll just draw attention to an interesting phenomenon with China that seems to be moving backwards. That's because of the growth of the scientific community. Many, many young scientists who publish papers that contribute to the denominator in the scale at the bottom, so it moves to the left. Then they become known, people start asking to collaborate with them, but that doesn't happen before their first few papers, so it turns around and moves to the right. So I expect China to follow an upward trend to the right, and you see Brazil turning around also. What are the benefits of international collaboration? These are the numbers of citations depending on the number of countries in which the authors are based. So one is purely domestic, two countries, three countries. This linear rise saturates at about 10, by the way. Now, you'd expect some increase because people read the papers of their neighbors and friends, and if you have collaborators in more than one country, you have more neighbors and friends. Nevertheless, I think that this shows that there are real benefits in international collaboration. Partly, of course, because only the best people get to collaborate. But I think this is important information, because science ministers may say to us, why are you collaborating? You're giving away knowledge. Yes, but we're taking back knowledge, and by working together, the whole is better than the sum of the parts. But it would be very interesting to do a little bit more research on this, but I think this is an important message. I now want to come to global approaches to tackle problems such as climate change, food, water, and energy security, and so on. Science is obviously crucial, and the question is, how can the many different players involved interact better to do a better job? Have we ever succeeded in the past? Yes, I give you two examples. The ozone hole, between the identification in the early 70s and the signing of the Montreal Protocol, was a very short period, a success. Smallpox, from the discovery of vaccines to the elimination of smallpox took nearly 200 years. But this was relatively easy. The science was clear. The threats were very easy to understand. The solutions were simple, not all that expensive, and there were no big losers. Today, we face much more complex problems where we don't all agree on the solutions. The solutions are going to be expensive, and they're going to be winners and losers, so it's much, much tougher. But at least the world has succeeded in those two examples. There are many players, many different forms of partnerships, various relevant bodies, and various initiatives. What we did in our study was to look at five examples to see what we could learn. And we're not trying to look what is the ideal model, it depends on the problem. But we think we've identified some pitfalls. So we looked at the International Panel on Climate Change, the work of the Gates Foundation, the Collaborative Group on International Agricultural Research, the Fusion Project, ITER, and I've chaired the board, I know a lot about that, and attempts to share information on carbon capture and storage. Well, the first thing is that there are three steps in this. There's identifying the problem, where fundamental science has a big role, and getting it on the radar screen of decision makers. That's the responsibility of the science academies and the science advisors to governments. Identifying forum to set up collaborations and then implementing them. And I want to discuss some of the messages we learned from these examples about implementation. First of all, if we're going to take a look at global solutions, then as many countries as possible must be involved in devising and assessing the solutions. It's no good a small group of countries coming in a colonialist way saying these are the solutions we think the world should adopt. Everybody's got to be at the table. And yet there is tension there, and I've been told it by people in these, between buy-in and quality, but we've got to get as many people as possible at the table, and this is yet another reason for scientific capacity building, not just in the natural sciences and the social sciences, so all the countries can work together, devising the solutions which we must then try to implement. There is tension between coordination, which seems a good idea at first, coordinate around the world, but it may discourage local initiative and prevent buy-in. The major philanthropic input is very welcome of Gates and so on, fast, flexible, but it's not accountable. And although it brings extra financial resources, it may move human resources from problems that other people may think are more important, so we have to be careful about it. But on balance, it's a good thing. It takes time to set up these global organizations. I can tell you from bitter experience, much more time you would expect, and that has to be balanced against the advantages when you want to go down the global route. There is tension between technical, political, and industrial interests, and I've seen that in many projects in which I've been involved, and intellectual property issues are a barrier. So this is just a list of the sort of challenges we have to face to look at when going down the collaborative route. Now, my final topic before one more slide is I want to say something about science for peace and talk briefly about two organizations with which I am or have been closely associated, set up under the umbrella of UNESCO, whose motto is Science for Peace, or part of its motto. The first is CERN, of which I was Director General. In fact, I wrote the proposal for the Large Hadron Collider. It's now forgotten that when CERN started, it had two aims. First, to enable the construction of a facility which was beyond the financial means or human capacity means of individual members. Secondly, it had a deliberate aim of trying to build bridges between countries which less than 5 years ago, when it was first thought of, had been at war. Modeled on that is SESAME, which stands for Synchrotron Light for Experimental Science and Applications in the Middle East, was conceived in the late 1990s with exactly the same aims. The members are currently Bahrain, Cyprus, Egypt, Iran, Israel, Jordan, Pakistan, the Palestinian Authority, and Turkey, but with UNESCO we are seeking new members. And when you go to the Council, some of the members have said to me, this is a parallel universe. We are sitting around the table with our neighbors trying to do something constructive instead of arguing with each other. We hope to get it commissioned in 2015, but it's going to need more help from outside, I think. But the key message of Sesame and CERN for Science for Peace is it won't work for peace and politics unless the science is good. My role in Sesame is to make sure it's an outstanding scientific instrument. If it is, the hotshot scientists from these countries will go there, and the political aims and the human aims will follow. If it isn't, they won't. It's as simple as that. I've given you the reference to the website where you can find some of our literature, especially these brochures, and I think Herman Vinnick is here with a lot of copies of these, which can be made available to people. To conclude, some of this analysis needs to be taken further. The analysis of governance of global organizations, OECD is looking at that. The search for metrics, UNESCO is looking at that. The scientific landscape is changing dramatically with new powers arising. Global scientific collaboration is a win-win situation and should be fostered. We exchange knowledge, we all benefit, the result is better than the sum of the parts. Combining forces to find solutions to global problems is desirable per se and necessary to ensure that the actions are accepted by all. But it's not straightforward, and we hope our analysis has identified some of the hazards. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, that we see the emergence of science across the globe and an increasingly integrated global scientific community. The good news is that that is a necessary condition for dealing with the problems we face at a global level. The bad news is that it's not sufficient. To solve the problems, we need science, we need industry, we need government and society. But at least I think science is getting in a position we can play our role, and I hope that in the years ahead we will find the solutions. Thank you very much.